From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by the Interventional Institute at Holy Name Hospital, offering non-surgical treatment options for people with inoperable or chronic conditions such as cancer, peripheral artery disease, uterine fibroids, and varicose veins. More at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the press had a buffet of Dick Cheney stories to dig into, and there's no question about which story they chose to gorge on.
Tough questions hang over the vice president and his behavior this weekend. There's a shooting.
Vice President Dick Cheney accidentally shot a prominent Republican lawyer as they were both hunting for quail.
Elizabeth, 78-year-old Harry Whittington remains in this hospital with birdshot on the right side of his face and chest.
Reporters wanting to know, but not finding out, why no official told the public.
I mean, the vice president knew immediately, oh no, I've shot somebody accidentally, and it takes 22
and you know what his first reaction was? His first reaction
on MSNBC's Hardball, Bill Maher said to Chris Matthews that he found it interesting that the hunting accident was, quote, only the third worst thing that happened to Dick Cheney this week, with the Valerie Plame thing and the Paul Pillar revelation. So the question is, in the midst of hunting mania, is anyone paying attention to what Maher called the Paul Pillar revelation and the Valerie Plame thing? Well, here's the Pillar revelation. The former CIA official, in an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, accused the White House of manufacturing a connection between 9/11 and Iraq in the lead-up to war. As to the Valerie Plame thing, well, Murray Wass has been covering the investigation into who leaked CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity for several years now, and he joins us with the latest.
Well, what happened last week is that court documents became unsealed in which Scooter Libby, the former chief of staff and national security advisor, Vice President Cheney, who's going to stand trial for five felonies, he essentially had told the prosecutors, according to the court papers, that although Cheney didn't specifically authorize him to leak Plame's name, Cheney had authorized him in a more general sense to leak classified information to defend the vice president, President Bush, more generally regarding allegations that they distorted or twisted intelligence to make the case to go to war with Iraq.
Do you think that this story about Libby basically pointing the finger at Cheney has been somewhat underreported in the scheme of things?
It got fairly big play. It was one of the first stories on the CBS Evening News and the second lead story on the NBC Evening News that night. The Washington Post and New York Times played it on the inside pages. That's more of a function of they were second to get the story. Brit Hume did address this in the interview that he had with the vice president. The vice president said he declined to say whether he specifically authorized him to leak, but he implicitly, I think, acknowledged that what Libby said is correct. The second thing he said, which is extraordinary, which has gotten underplayed, is he said that he has the right, as the vice president, at his whim and will, as does the president, to declassify any information he likes. Therefore, there's no wrongdoing.
The interview with Fox News' Brit Hume was on Wednesday. A couple of years ago, President Bush did delegate the right to classify information to the vice president, but it was never clear that the vice president also had the right to declassify information, except information that he directly oversaw that was coming out of his office. So that does seem to be the new wrinkle here. If they can claim the ability to declassify anything, then he never gets called up on charges of revealing classified information, because by dint of revealing it, he's declassified it.
True. I mean, what he asserted in the Brit Hume interview was an extraordinary and radical expansion of executive authority, that gives the president almost imperial authority to control the flow of information. And it raises profound issues, I think, for democracy.
Well, let me ask you, as somebody who's covered the Plame affair so closely, which of the Dick Cheney stories of recent days do you think is the most important? The Valerie Plame wrinkle that Scooter Libby has pointed the finger at his boss? The revelation in Foreign Affairs magazine that a former CIA official is accusing Cheney and the administration of manufacturing a connection between 9/11 and Iraq? Or the fact that Dick Cheney accidentally shot his hunting partner in the face?
Well, I think they're all, in an interesting way, interrelated. They all relate to the fact that the administration, and Cheney in particular, they think that they should control the flow of information to the public, whether it's about a hunting accident, whether it's how we got into the war. Each separate instance, the White House is asserting bold authority to restrict and control information that goes beyond what's been traditionally done. And the hunting incident is kind of emblematic of the other two.
Libby's trial is scheduled to begin in January of 2007.
Correct.
What do you think we should expect in the intervening 10 months? Another shoe going to drop?
The investigation of the Deputy White House Chief of Staff, President Bush's Chief Political Advisor, Karl Rove, continues. We could see other criminal charges in the case. It looks like, however, that Libby will go to trial, and there won't be a plea bargain in this case, most likely, at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Or there's no indication of that.
Do you think they'll finish his trial before the 08 election?
The best guess right now is that the trial should be over by the 2008 elections, yes.
Okay. Murray, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Murray Wass is a staff writer for the National Journal.
In dealing with his hunting accident, the vice president froze out the White House press corps, the usual course for a White House that works around the filter of big media. To that end, it also offers a steady stream of press releases and photo handouts to feed the media beast and erode the impulse to do actual reporting. Susan Walsh is an Associated Press photographer and president of the White House News Photographers Association. Last July, after it was announced that there were to be 5 photo handouts in a single week, Walsh decided enough was enough. She searched through the Getty archives and those of the AP and calculated that in the 5 years of the Bush presidency, there had been more than 500 photo handouts. Susan Walsh joins me now. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The White House issues handouts of photos that its own photographers have taken. The news organization gets them. Then what happens to those images?
Well, typically those press releases just get passed along and basically just put back out there for the television stations, websites, and news organizations to publish.
And do they?
Yes, quite frequently. And you would never expect a White House press release, no matter how many thousands of them that there are, you would never expect any of those to be published verbatim without any fact-checking or anything. But for some reason, with still pictures, they just get put out there.
So when these still photos are distributed and they show up in newspapers and on television and on the web and so forth, are they identified as having come from a White House photographer as opposed to a photojournalist?
Not always. Sometimes it'll only be credited to the news organization that distributed the photo. Sometimes it'll have the news organization that distributed the photo with the photographer's name, not being a journalist, but a White House photographer. So it's very unclear to the reader really where this image came from.
In November, I talked to Santiago Lyon, who is the AP's director of photography and I suppose one of your bosses. And we talked
yes.
about the use of military handout photos. Now, it's very clear to me why a military handout photo may tell a different story of war than a photo taken by a real journalist. But when it comes to images of the president sitting at his desk or at the podium of a press conference or, I don't know, playing with his dog, is one photo really going to tell a dramatically different story than another?
You can have 5 photographers go and shoot the same event, and you'll come back with, you know, dozens of different images. So when you have only one set of eyes capturing one event, you only see it through one perspective. Plus, you don't know what was edited out. Did the president trip? Was he sad? Was he happy? Was there something else going on that we didn't get a chance to see and to document? Here's an example. The night that John Roberts was to be nominated for Supreme Court Justice, the White House originally wanted to have that as a handout photo. Of course, all the news organizations went up in arms, and it ended up being what they call an expanded pool coverage. So there were photographers allowed in there. Now, as you might remember, the television coverage pretty much stayed on the president. And you never saw John Roberts' son, Jack, dancing over in the sidelines, making the, you know, the funny little gestures that he was doing. Now, if that would have been a handout photo, would we have seen Jack doing what he was doing in the sides? I don't know.
You mentioned that in the case of the John Roberts nomination announcement, that the press was up in arms, that it had been scheduled to exclude photojournalists. Why isn't the press in a constant state of being up in arms about the whole idea of photo handouts?
Amongst ourselves, we've complained. We've been upset. We get frustrated. But there hasn't been necessarily an audience. And as WHMPA president, I've decided to take this on as one of our association's main missions, which is to bring attention to this and to try and improve access and make it so that handout photos are not something we do routinely.
I'm curious about your own news organization, the Associated Press. You sounded the alarm. Has your outfit responded?
Yes. Actually, the AP has now established a policy where they are reviewing the handouts that they receive. A manager will either sign off on using that picture or passing a picture. And one of the criteria is if there's a photo and it was of an event that clearly could have accommodated press coverage, that they are likely to pass that photo.
Now, we didn't find you randomly. We read about you and this situation in Editor and Publisher magazine. I'm curious, what was the reaction to that piece?
My colleagues, fellow photojournalists in Washington, are very proud of the fact that we're bringing attention to this. On the other hand, people on the other side of the fence are not as happy.
The other side of the fence? Do you mean at newspaper management or at the White House itself?
At the White House.
How do you know they're unhappy?
A couple of phone calls and an email.
And did they say, we respectfully disagree, or did they say, how dare you, or did they say, we're going to tap your international phone calls? I mean, what level of unhappiness are we talking about?
Well, as I joked with my husband, I said, well, we should prepare to be audited.
Well, Susan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Photojournalist Susan Walsh is president of the White House News Photographers Association.
Coming up, Congress grills Google and others about Chinese censorship, and Chinese citizens denounce censorship too.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and Cisco were called to Capitol Hill on Wednesday to answer charges that they are collaborating with a repressive regime, namely China. Now, these fresh-faced, forward-looking companies are not used to being pegged as the bad guys. They're not big oil or big tobacco. But with people being jailed because Yahoo gave information to Chinese police and blogs shut down by Microsoft at the request of Chinese officials, these companies face a profound and very public moral dilemma over the real cost of doing big business. From Washington, Jessica Smith reports.
Suddenly, these icons of new media are looking at a stain spreading like an oil slick over their image. On Wednesday, they took a tongue-lashing from both sides of the aisle. Here's New Jersey Republican Chris Smith. He chaired the hearing at the House Human Rights Subcommittee.
Women and men are going to the gulag and being tortured as a direct result of information handed over to Chinese officials. When Yahoo was asked to explain its actions, Yahoo said that it must adhere to local laws in all countries where it operates. But my response to that is, if the secret police a half century ago asked where Anne Frank was hiding, would the correct answer be to hand over the information in order to comply with local laws?
California Democrat Tom Lantos addressed the lawyer from Cisco, a company now under attack for its sales of high-tech surveillance and fingerprinting technology to Chinese police.
Is there anything that you have done in the whole period you operated in China that the company ought to be ashamed of?
Our company provides access to information for people all over the world, including China, on a consistent global platform which maximizes the opportunity for freedom of expression, and we think that is a positive thing that we do throughout the world, including China.
So your answer is you have nothing to be ashamed of?
My answer is I feel that our engagement is consistent with our government's goals, and it's a positive
engagement.
Let me
move on to your colleagues. What is your answer, sir?
Lantos, a Holocaust survivor, moved on to Google's Elliot Schrage.
We comply with legally binding orders, whether it's here in the United States or in China or any of the other 90 countries.
Well, IBM complied with legal orders when they cooperated with Nazi Germany.
One of the problems for these companies is that they can't operate in China unless they comply with Chinese law. But they can't not operate in China. It's too big of a market. There are more than 110 million internet users there, and the internet is transforming China. Microsoft lawyer Jack Krumholtz voices the general industry justification for doing business there.
We, too, think on balance that it's better for these for Microsoft and the other companies here at the table and other U.S. Internet companies to be engaged in China. We think that the benefits far outweigh the downside in terms of promoting freedom of expression.
One lonely lawmaker voiced sympathy for the company's China dilemma, Washington State Democrat Adam Smith.
Let's assume for the moment that no U.S. tech company does business in China. Does it get better? Is it less repressive? Does China move forward? I don't think so, not in the least bit.
At the end of the four-hour grilling, the companies looked pretty charred.
I heard nothing today that would make me think that anyone using the internet in China will be any safer in the near future than they have been in the past.
That's Bob Dietz with the Committee to Protect Journalists. He says most of the Chinese citizens jailed as a result of internet activities are journalists or bloggers. And the only thing the U.S. can do is pressure U.S. companies not to assist in any repression. But Dietz is skeptical anyone in the U.S. can do anything to change censorship in China.
Those problems will be resolved by the Chinese and the Chinese people and Chinese journalists confronting their own government. We certainly might assist them or work with them and try and help them, but finally it's a Chinese problem.
Yes, the internet does facilitate freedom of speech and free flow of information.
That's Rebecca McKinnon, a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. She blogged from the hearing.
But, you know, there are also uses of technology that can be quite evil. And so I think just to say, oh, over the long run, the internet is going to make the Chinese more free, so therefore we shouldn't be held responsible for the ruining of individual people's lives, I don't think that gets them off the hook.
She says the pressure applied by these hearings parallels what happened to American manufacturers operating in the 80s and 90s in the Third World,
where, you know, suddenly a lot of attention was put by human rights groups on child labor practices, on environmental practices, and now it's considered normal that companies have to be careful about the environmental and labor implications of what they're doing around the world.
McKinnon notes that the companies are already responding to the pressure. There's talk of setting up new codes of conduct. The administration weighed in this week with the announcement of a new global Internet Freedom Task Force. On Thursday, Congressman Chris Smith put forth a proposal aimed at protecting U.S. companies from being forced to cooperate with repressive governments. It's not clear how much any of these efforts will influence regimes to moderate their behavior. What is clear is that these hearings have put new media companies on notice, that they're no longer flying under the radar of Congress and public opinion. They're huge corporations with huge bottom lines, and they have to live with the scrutiny that goes with that. For On the Media, this is Jessica Smith in Washington.
China's tough line on the internet has made headlines this week in connection with the congressional hearings, but perhaps more alarming is China's recent crackdown on publications, even those run by the Communist Party. Just a few weeks ago, China's propaganda department shut down Freezing Point, a weekly supplement of the China Youth Daily, itself an official party organ. Although Freezing Point was known for aggressive reporting on farm protests and other social unrest, New York Times Beijing bureau chief Joseph Kahn says it wasn't one of those stories that put the freeze on Freezing Point.
The last article that they published that seemed to go over the line was a long essay by a historian in Guangdong province who looked at some of the treatment of history in official textbooks and how that compared with what he viewed as sort of the reality of some of the wars with foreign powers in the late 19th century. Hmm.
So it was what would seem to Western ears to be fairly unexplosive accusations of historical revisionism from 125 years ago. Someone was fed up to hear. But then what happened next was quite unusual. There was pushback from the Freezing Point and others. How did it play out?
The editor of Freezing Point is a very experienced and wily veteran of sort of the ways of the newspaper business and the elite party-run journals, a gentleman named Li Datong. And in late January and early February, he managed to get a group of liberal but respected retired party leaders to sign a petition calling on the leadership to reopen Freezing Point and also to allow Li Datong to resume his position as editor, saying that China was at a delicate transition and desperately needed to have a more independent, freewielding, and investigation-oriented press that can help expose problems before they become so big that the government is unable to grapple with them.
Now, the upshot of this, which occurred actually, I think, while you were flying back from China, is that the propaganda department reported that the Freezing Point would be permitted to publish again, albeit with a different editorial staff. What do you make of this development?
Li Datong and his deputy, the two of them together, were identified entirely with Freezing Point. It doesn't have a sort of a separate mission without those two in charge of it. So it does not appear at this stage that they have managed to turn back the essence, anyway, of the order, although it's clear that the authorities are eager to show that they're not exceeding their authority by simply shutting down an entire publication because of something that they determined to be offensive.
The government and the party seem, on the one hand, to be permitting much more kind of aggressive press questioning and investigations, and then at some point reacting and, you know, once again repressing, firing people, jailing people. Can you tell whether this government wishes to liberalize the press or just what it has in mind?
It's a good question. I think they really do need the media to convey in a lively way the essence of official orders and directives. So they want an effective and well-read press. But I think actually more important is they don't want to pay any money to the press. Aside from a very small number of elite national publications, of which China Youth Daily is not one, they force all the newspapers, many or most of the TV stations, certainly all the internet sites, to support themselves through advertising or circulation revenue or subscription revenue. So these publications are hostage to their reputation in the marketplace, and that has proven consistently to be at least as powerful, if not more powerful, motivating force for these publications than what the officials want.
So I guess that, you know, there's another classic 2006 Chinese paradox. You've got this free market communist country, which expects its papers to operate for profit based on readership, and yet is essentially taking the editorial prerogatives out of the hands of the people who are trying to sell newspapers. Do you suppose that the market motivation itself will persuade them to let newspapers operate as they will?
I just don't see the pressure for change going away. I think Freezing Point, at least for some period of time, is going to be run without its inspirational editors, and other publications can be successfully shut down or the editorial leadership reshuffled. But you tend to see these people and these issues popping up constantly, and their pushback against interference by the propaganda department gets stronger and stronger, not weaker and weaker.
Okay. Well, Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Joseph Kahn is Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. He joined us just off an airplane in Salt Lake City.
This week, Congress skewered U.S. internet providers for their willingness to comply with Chinese authorities, but another far older group of communication providers has a long history of sometimes illegal compliance with the government, namely our phone companies with our government. Revelations about the National Security Agency's use of phone companies for domestic surveillance have raised new questions about when the industry should comply with official requests to pry. And while the Senate announced Thursday that it would not soon be launching an investigation, the House says it will. Also this week, a federal judge ordered the Justice Department to release documents related to the wiretap program. It wouldn't be the first time the courts and Congress have weighed in to curtail such programs. In 1967, the Supreme Court placed limits on the practice, and Morton Halperin, who served in the Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton administrations, explains that in 1975, the Church Committee exposed decades of overreaching by several administrations.
Well, Congress looked at various forms of abuses, including abuses of electronic surveillance, often at the request of the Nixon administration. There were programs focused on government officials, including me, and members of the press. And there were earlier programs directed at the steel industry, directed at Martin Luther King Jr. There were a number of abuses that were reported.
Tell me about what happened to you.
Well, I was working with Henry Kissinger on the NSC staff in the Nixon administration, and there was a story that appeared in the New York Times saying that the United States had begun bombing Cambodia. Nixon ordered Kissinger to begin a program of wiretapping. Kissinger supplied my name and that of other people to the FBI. The FBI then had a system worked out whereby a key person in the FBI would call the chief of security at AT&T and just give him a phone number. There was no paper, there was no justification, there was no explanation of how this related to national security. The AT&T security officer would take that phone number and arrange for those phone conversations to be fed into the local FBI field office where people would listen to them and transcribe them. And that was done with my home phone for 21 months.
Do you know if AT&T put up any resistance to being used for surveillance?
Not until they began to be sued. At that point, AT&T went to the Ford administration and said, you know, that we cannot continue to do these surveillances just on the word of an FBI official. We're going to have some more routine system. The Ford administration feared that the phone company would stop providing the cooperation that they needed unless there was a legal system established by Congress.
That is the court, FISA, that was set up to approve secret wiretapping. And you advocated for the FISA court.
Yeah. I thought it was important to regularize the system. And one of the reasons Congress thought that was so important was to send a clear message to the telephone company. You cooperate if the executive is doing wiretaps pursuant to these rules, and you refuse to cooperate if they're operating outside these rules.
Did AT&T derive any benefit from complying readily with these requests?
Well, the main benefit they got is there was constant pressure to break up AT&T, which was a telecommunications monopoly. The Justice Department was stopped from doing that by the National Security Establishment, which would go to the president and say that the national interest required that there be a single telecommunications company that could cooperate with the government. So AT&T had a big stake in having the national security establishment and the government feeling that they were cooperative.
Obviously, the technology by which we communicate has undergone a lot of important changes in the last 30 years. And I wonder how the NSA, for example, has taken advantage of the changing ways in which we communicate.
What technology has done is made it much harder for the government to intercept communications. It was much easier to do it when you were dealing with satellites because the satellite stuff is all in the air and NSA could grab it. Recently, a lot of calls that used to go through satellites now go through fiber optic cables. That's why the law requires the phone companies to construct their systems so that they can be overheard.
As far as we know, the old wiretapping cases involved picking out a person and then wiretapping them. This case involves vacuuming in keywords, right?
No. There are clearly two different NSA programs. One that the president has described is an old-fashioned wiretapping program, putting wiretaps on the home phones of Americans who they believe are having conversations with somebody abroad where they believe the person abroad is a member of Al-Qaeda. My belief is that there is a second program which NSA began after 9/11, which does involve the vacuuming up of large quantities of data and a search through it for keywords. The Attorney General, when he testified before the Judiciary Committee in public, was asked whether there was any other program, which they were not describing, basically declined to answer that question in a public session.
It seems that with so much competition within the telecommunications industry, there would be greater pressure for them to prove to their consumers that they are protecting the public's interest.
Yeah, but nobody wants to be responsible for having shut off the phone call which came saying, go blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. So I think it's unlikely that a phone company will go that far. My hope is that they would say to the government what AT&T said in the early 70s, which is, we're going to continue this for a while, but you need to go to Congress and get this authorized, or at some point we're going to have to shut it down.
Well, Morton Halperin, thank you very much.
Not at all. It's my pleasure.
Morton Halperin is the director of U.S. Advocacy for the Open Society Institute.
Up next, a new study suggests that the Sunday chat shows tilt right, and a new film ponders what if the South had won the Civil War.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with this update. This week, Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas placed all official media under his own personal control. Up until now, Abbas and his Fatah party have left the media largely independent. But the Hamas party, which takes control of parliament on Saturday, has threatened to do away with such independence. Fadi Hamad of Hamas declared that it will request that Western music be banned from all Palestinian radio, One employee at independent radio station Gaza FM said that under Hamas, they will be required to play the Quran for hours. The station has already received death threats. Abbas's moves on the media follow his appointment of Fatah allies to key governmental posts. It's not clear whether Abbas, who remains as Palestinian Authority chairman, will use his control of the media to protect its independence or as a tool to undermine his political opponents. Hamas has already said it would try to overturn his appointments if it can amass a two-thirds majority in the parliament. As for Abbas's seizure of the media, Hamas has decried it as illegal, but has not said how it will respond.
For some 10 million Americans, it's a Sunday morning ritual. Not exactly church, but it does involve some very influential people holding forth. I mean, of course, the Sunday morning talk shows, NBC's Meet the Press, CBS's Face the Nation, and ABC's This Week. Many more people tune into the network's nightly newscasts, but according to Paul Waldman of the liberal media watchdog group Media Matters for America, the Sunday shows play a unique role among our most powerful news outlets.
For instance, the New York Times really sets the news agenda for almost the rest of the journalistic universe. The network newscasts in the evening have the largest audience. What the Sunday talk shows do is, more than any other news presentation, they set the parameters of debate. What kinds of views are inside that reasonable debate and outside that reasonable debate? If certain kinds of people are always outside of that debate, their views are not considered important enough, and then that spreads to other media. If everyone is debating, you know, how should we go about invading Iran, just to take one hypothetical example that might occur in the future, as opposed to whether or not it's a good idea to invade Iran, then that debate ends up contributing greatly to the debate that's actually taking place in the country and in the halls of Congress, and the choices get constricted, and that, in the end, has consequences for policy.
We tune into these shows to hear from the powerful, and so it's no surprise that these days the guest list tends to skew right. But this week, Waldman and Media Matters for America released a study claiming that the shows tilted a little right, even during the last 4 years of the Clinton administration. NBC wouldn't talk to us on tape, but did respond with a statement charging Waldman with faulty methodology. If he had looked at the guest list for Meet the Press during the first Clinton term, NBC says, he would have seen that at least that show actually featured more Democrats. Waldman shot back by accusing NBC of comparing apples to oranges, the apples being government officials on Meet the Press, and the oranges being all guests, government officials and journalists, on all three of the Sunday shows. But even if you stick with apples, says Waldman, you'd see that there were more Republicans on Meet the Press under Bush than there were Democrats in the Clinton years.
Well, the numbers at NBC for Clinton's first term taken in its entirety show that there was a 12 percentage point advantage for Democrats over Republicans. But if you look at Meet the Press for Bush's first term, which would be the relevant comparison, there's actually a 24-point advantage for Republicans over Democrats, twice as large. Now, that's one element, is the administration and elected officials who get on the shows. But let's look at another element. One of the things that Meet the Press and This Week in particular feature is journalist roundtables. And what you find again and again and again on these roundtables is that you'll have neutral reporters matched up with conservative opinion writers. Let's just take one illustration. This past October, there was an episode of Meet the Press that featured a roundtable discussing Iraq of David Broder, a centrist columnist for the Washington Post, Judy Woodruff, an anchor for CNN, William Sapphire, a conservative opinion writer for the New York Times, and David Brooks, another conservative opinion writer for the New York Times. Now, what's missing from this picture? Well, of course, it's a progressive. And you see this again and again and again, that we have conservative opinion writers who are supposed to be balanced by neutral journalists with no progressives anywhere. That's something that actually didn't change from the Clinton years to the Bush years, and if anything, only got worse during the Bush years.
Let me lay out an idea for you to respond to. This comes from Todd Gitlin, an avowedly liberal media critic. Since conservatives tend to be more zealous about their politics, conservatives play better on the air. And so for commercial reasons, television and radio talk will be disproportionately right-wing. Do you think that the media performance of liberals is to blame for this imbalance?
You know, I've heard that argument from a lot of liberals, actually, that liberals' views are just too complex. They don't reduce as well to sound bites. That may be an argument that someone on a show like, say, Hardball or Scarborough Country might make. But that's not what the Sunday morning shows are about. They're not looking for the people with the snappiest sound bites or the loudest voices. They're supposed to be looking for people who are articulate and can speak to important pressing issues of the day and have some influence on how they're going to end up. And that actually brings us to another point, which is that you do see that some particular individuals tend to be on again and again and again. And that means that the debate is narrowed in any number of ways to the perspectives of those individuals. During this 9-year period, John McCain was on the Sunday shows 124 times. The person who comes in second is Joe Biden at 80. So McCain is really the go-to guest. But there's something else that's interesting about McCain, which is that when he gets interviewed, he's almost always interviewed alone. Ordinarily, when a senator comes on the show, he or she is usually balanced by a senator from the other party. Now, that suggests to me that they believe he's different than regular politicians, that he's a unique character, a maverick who doesn't need to be refuted from somebody else by the party because he kind of stands aside from all that. But you can make a case that, you know, he's as conservative as most other Republicans, and perhaps he should be refuted from someone from the other party.
Okay, let's take it as read that John McCain inspires a certain veneration in the press that we won't go into here. But laying McCain aside for a moment, isn't the nature of these programs to be somewhat adversarial? I mean, if Tim Russert is, say, sitting with Dick Cheney, isn't he the one who's supposed to be asking the tough questions and not just give Cheney an opportunity to make a stump speech?
Well, that is, I think, how the shows would like to think of themselves. But I think if that's really what they're about, the administration coming on to be interviewed and to air its views and to be questioned, then let's call it that. And then let's not have anybody from the other party at all, because what's the point if the purpose of the shows is just to have the administration state its case and then have a host ask questions about that case? But if they're going to claim to be having a debate in which both sides are represented, then they have an obligation to have something that at least over time looks like balance.
If we take your point that there are more conservatives and Republicans on these shows than perhaps there ought to be for a good balance and a fair airing of the debates, why?
Why has it happened?
Yeah.
You know, that would require some speculation. And we don't make any allegation that the people who produce the show or have some sort of sinister conspiracy at work that are trying to advance a Republican agenda. But that habit of having neutral journalists providing balance for conservative writers suggests the possibility, at least, that the people who put together these shows have internalized this idea that reporters must be liberals. And so, therefore, if you have a couple of people from the National Review on, you can balance them by having a couple of reporters. I can tell you that that has been the Republican strategy for around 40 years, to keep the media under constant pressure, accuse them of liberal bias at every turn. And as a consequence, a lot of reporters, the way they deal with that is that they bend over backwards to show that they're not being liberal. And so they're tougher on Democrats. Now, I don't know if that's true with regard to the Sunday shows, but it's certainly true to one extent or another with a lot of reporters in Washington.
All right. Paul, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America.
CSA, the Confederate States of America, opened this week. The film imagines America had the South won the Civil War, which is not so absurd a scenario as it may sound. Had British and French forces come to the aid of the Confederacy, as they at least contemplated, the military outcome might have been very different. With that as a premise, filmmaker Kevin Wilmot presents a weirdly plausible version of American history. Under the Confederate States of America, Abraham Lincoln is captured in blackface trying to escape to Canada, Reconstruction picks up the pieces of the shattered North, and slavery is the law of the land. It all plays out in what looks like a Ken Burns documentary, complete with slow pans of still photos and talking head historians. But it's not on public TV, and the commercials that punctuate it present a hilarious and disturbing look at the contemporary consequences of this historical what-if. Kevin Wilmot says he didn't even have to dream up every detail of the CSA. Some of them sprang from actual consumer goods and retail businesses.
That's the power of Ducky. Ducky!
For a shine that's
Jigaboo Bright.
So, you know, you've got products like Darkey Toothpaste, and you've got the Coon Chicken Inn, and you've got thousands of products with Sambo in the label. It was a normal part of American life. There's still some of those around today, though. There's still products that have slavery kind of based imagery that sell them.
You're talking about Aunt Jemima syrup and Uncle Ben's converted rice. But I got to tell you, it was jaw-dropping to see at the end of the film a photograph of the entrance to a Coon Chicken Inn somewhere in the Midwest where you, to enter the restaurant, you actually walk through the mouth of a racistly drawn Pullman porter.
Yes. Yeah, that's a pretty shocking one. But it's important to remember that it's not abnormal. That was not a family of racist people that did that. That was just ordinary American citizens at the time. And that's the thing that I hope CSA kind of does. It shows how anything can become normal. You know, people say, well, would slavery still exist today? Well, anything can become normal if you work hard to make it a normality.
I couldn't help but notice that the arguments forwarded by the proponents of slavery in your film eerily echo some of the rhetoric in our current state of affairs,
yes.
The constant harping on patriotism and security and Christian tradition. Was that intentional or just kind of a bonus?
It's not intentional. I think it's the arguments that you hear today are just not new arguments. They come from the same kind of CSA thinking, in my opinion. Throughout our entire history, it's been this challenge of what country do we want to be, the USA or the CSA? So the CSA becomes, for me anyway, a metaphor that's bigger than just the issue of slavery. I think slavery is the root of it all that creates it all, but it takes on these many different forms.
The documentary within your film is done in the style of a Ken Burns documentary, complete with the Southern historian posed before his bookcase full of, you know, of literature.
There were many who were clamoring for Mr. Lincoln's execution also, but President Davis understood that sparing Lincoln's life would ease tensions in the North. A wise man, he was already looking to the future.
Within the film, you have constant references to the popular culture at certain points in Confederate States of American history.
Mm-hmm.
My particular favorite was from a pretend 1946 RKO film called The Jefferson Davis Story, in which a key historical role is played by someone you call renowned Shakespearean actor Sir Frederick Littlefield. He is playing the house slave, essentially the butler in blackface.
I must find a way to bring the North into our way of life. If I don't, may spell disaster. Master President, may an old no-count darky like me ask a question?
Now, there were many little bits of parody throughout the film. One beautiful takeoff on the TV show Cops. What was it called?
Runaway.
Runaway. It was about officers of the law chasing down, pursuing, and capturing runaway slaves.
Yes.
But then there were a series of TV commercials, including one that absolutely perfectly mimicked one of these cheesy, you know, cable at 3 a.m. commercials aimed at morons. It's not for the Clapper. It's for a product called the Shackle. Let's listen to that.
Introducing the Shackle, the revolutionary new way of servant monitoring. Just place the shackle around his or her wrist, and when your property strays from your designated area, in minutes, the authorities have your chattel in custody.
Yes.
And, you know, it's done complete with idiots over-demonstrating the use of the shackle.
Right.
So it happens that as a cinematic technique, you rely heavily on fake old movies and fake TV commercials and other artifacts of the popular culture. How crucial were they to spinning this tale of near reality?
I wanted it to be a modern tale, and we get our history from movies far more than we do books nowadays. And you know, growing up as a kid, I saw all those old movies and the ones we satire in the film. And it's a funny way to do it. You know, I loved the movie Zelig. It was a big influence on me with this film. You know, taking those clips and finding the right little moment to share from these Hollywood films was a way for us to, you know, make the documentary real and to make it humorous, hopefully, and to also reveal some hidden history as well.
There was one passage in which we see documentary footage of John F. Kennedy talking about slavery. And it was definitely his voice.
Yes.
I mean, it was seamless.
Yes.
In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. In giving rights to others which belong to them, we give rights to ourselves and to our country.
I'm trying to figure out how you pulled that off.
Well, we were very lucky on that one. Kennedy, for black folks, was like Abraham Lincoln. He was loved and admired because he was interested in civil rights. And the thing that we found was a speech he made about the 100-year anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Then we found in the Kennedy-Nixon debate where he talks about slavery, but he's actually talking about the threat of communism. And then my editor was able to put it together and make a few little adjustments, and it just knocked us out of our seat. And those are the things that I think makes the film so special. We didn't want to wink at the camera and kind of make you go, we're all just kidding. This is all just tongue in cheek. We wanted it to really kind of give some discomfort, for it to be real enough that you really have to question things a bit. And hopefully the film does that.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Kevin Wilmot, an assistant professor in film studies at the University of Kansas, is the writer and director of CSA, the Confederate States of America. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and all kinds of other help from Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.